Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. Before we get into why Rex is in what appears to be a Delta lounge, I want to start this podcast by saying Team Golf is absolutely taking over the golf world, at least for 1 week. Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry team up to win the Zurich Classic of New Orleans in a playoff, while Cam Smith and the hometown Australian Rippers GC win a home game at LIV Adelaide. Rex, what caught your eye?
Well, New Orleans. I was really interested in that, and only because, and it's funny because you and I had this conversation on the podcast on Wednesday about better formats, and I sort of dismissed you, but I was watching the coverage on ESPN Plus, and I believe it was Brian Katrick was talking about all of the different, like he can't rattle off like five different formats that he'd like to see, and all of them were like a shamble, and everything that you and I would play if we went and played in a tournament. And I was kind of like, yeah, I'd like to see him mix it up a little bit.
But welcome. Welcome to my world. Two-man best ball does just not hit. It really doesn't. It's boring to watch.
I mean, it's a lot of birdies. If you don't like, I mean, I can see it if you don't like birdies. I will say I'm compelled by the foursomes play on Sunday. And I was a little thrown by, and I don't know how much you paid attention to the playoffs. So what they would have done is they played 18 foursomes. And then if they had to go one more hole, they would have gone to 17 and played as a four ball. That to me was a little confusing, a little overkill. Let's stick with one or the other, because I know how hard you and I both have played foursomes before. We know, I mean, it's the most brutal format on the planet because you're always letting your partner down. That to me was compelling. So I don't mind that at all.
So I guess we're going to start this podcast speaking negatively. So Wednesday, I brought up the fact I didn't like the two-man best ball. Everything I saw this week just further strengthened that argument. It's slow. It's not exciting. Yes, you can see a lot of birdies, but every team's making a lot of birdies. If you actually want to separate the good teams from the mediocre teams from the poor teams, yeah, you lean into the alternate shot. You lean into the formats where there's a greater sort of disparity in scoring. Like the 63 that Chad Ramey and Martin Trainer shot on Sunday, the tournament record, was an amazing round of golf, and it put them in a position to win the golf tournament when I think ordinarily, had they played I think the two-man best ball format, there was zero chance that that team was going to win the golf tournament for 4 days of that. So I still don't think this tournament is working. Maybe it's the venue. Maybe it's TPC Louisiana. Maybe it's the field, which is watered down with a lot of guys who either have very limited status, conditional status, no status at all when it comes to Russ Cochran. Maybe it needs to move to a different part of the schedule. To me, it just doesn't capture the imagination of the fans. I say that, however, Rex, so that's not capturing the imagination of the fans. I think when you look at Rory McIlroy and the week that he had, this was his tournament debut, he was having the time of his life. This is a guy who desperately needed to have some sort of fun competitively inside the ropes. We've seen it at the Ryder Cup every 2 years. That sort of brings out a different side of his personality. Now we see him alongside one of his best friends in all the world, and Shane Lowry, a guy he's known for more than two decades. The video of him belting out Journey's Don't Stop Believing on stage at the 19th hole was absolutely hilarious.
That was the best. I love that.
I think the players really enjoy it, but I don't think that necessarily translates to the viewer experience.
I can see what you're saying. And look, we could sit here and split hairs over four ball, better ball, whatever you want to call it, simply because it's so odd in the professional game. I mean, it's something that you and I play all the time in pro-ams. Again, I'm kind of drawn to the foursomes play because you're right. That seems to identify the better players, the better teams. I will say that watching New Orleans the last couple of days led me to another conclusion that I really didn't have. I've heard other journalists make this argument before, but the Olympics should go to something along these lines where it's kind of a team.
Anything's better than 72-hole stroke play.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's probably something to be said for that, whatever the format is. Again, I think 4 days of foursomes would become exhausting for the players, if not the fans. But I do enjoy that format. I don't mind. I mean, look, we do four ball at the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup. It seems to work just fine. No one seems to complain about it then. The rounds are slow, but I think, again, this is the old timey pace of play conversation that we had last week. I don't think that's going to change one way or the other. I was compelled by it. I watched it. I was interested. You're right. Watching Rory in that element, that team element, it helps when you have your best friend that you're playing alongside. I thought it was fun.
Like when you think about Rory and his energy levels all week, certainly his energy levels when he was pounding the Michelob Ultras afterward. Like, you can clearly see how much it meant to Rory to be part of a team, to be part of some of this like collective achievement. And so I do think there is room on the PGA Tour schedule in the future for a team event. I still don't think this is the best answer, but I think this week should embolden those who do believe that team play can and should be incorporated into whatever the PGA Tour is eventually going to look like. Rory in the past has brought up the cricket format, and I'm not sure if you're entirely familiar. Best I can tell, there's like a regular season cricket format, and then they carve out like 2 or 3 months in the spring or summer to basically just have team competition. That would obviously involve an entire reworking of the entire PGA Tour schedule and the major championship schedule as well. The thinking going, move the PGA Championship to the fall, early winter, and space it out over 12 months. That runs counter to everything that we've seen over the past couple of years, where they're trying to condense it, where they're trying to make it a sprint, where they're trying to finish before college football and the NFL season begins. So I'm still a little bit skeptical that that could actually happen. But I do think these sorts of events, particularly if it's integrated with LIV, particularly if there's this sort of franchise model, I do think it can work 4 to 6 times, because I think the players, with the right combination of players, with the right events, with the right fan experience, which I think is what kind of falls flat in New Orleans, I really do think that this can be a hugely successful model for the PGA Tour. It's just not what it currently is.
And I would turn that back on you and say, okay, then give me the format that you think you're going to like more than this, because I don't think there's anything proven out there outside of the Ryder Cup and to a certain degree the President's
Cup. I'd like to see a two-man match play competition.
Yeah, I mean, we could do that. I guess, well, a couple things. One, you're right about New Orleans. The fan experience is awful, and it's because they're on the wrong side of the river. I mean, my wife's family's from there. I've covered it. You've covered it enough times. When you and I go to cover it, we stay on the French Quarter side, where most people stay who would want to go to a golf tournament. People who live in the city, people who live in the suburbs. I mean, they built City Park, essentially rebuilt City Park after Hurricane Katrina, specifically with the idea of bringing the tournament there. So I'm not quite sure why it never worked out. You could turn that into a party. You could turn it into something really, really cool if you just relocated it. Just to pull back the curtain here, obviously I'm in the Sky Lounge, so I'm having to use my inside voice.
Yes, we're gonna have to rework the audio to just boost the energy levels, just boost the volume just a touch.
It's early in the morning, it's Monday morning, I'm getting a lot of dirty looks, and people do not want to hear me spouting off nonsense at 8 a.m in the Sky Lounge. But no, I think we could create something special. You immediately took the leap of, okay, this is how we incorporate LIV Golf into the PGA Tour. I'm not quite sure it's going to be that seamless, but I see where you're going.
Which does seem a perfect transition, potentially seamless, into LIV Adelaide. And afterward, Greg Norman didn't necessarily call what happened at LIV Adelaide vindication, but he did say that he feels sorry for the ignorance of others and those who are ignoring or dismissing what is happening. 35,000 people turned out on site to see the final round of LIV Adelaide, which was won in a team playoff, the first time they've had a team playoff in 2.5 years of LIV golf between the Australian team and the South African team. And I do think, Rex, that there was an important lesson here, that fan engagement is the key to all of this. I don't think it's any coincidence that this is what the PGA Tour model is trying to do as well, specifically when you bring in the Strategic Sports Group and the vast experience that they have running sports franchises, to see how you can kind of key into the younger demographic and make things more of a happening. When I asked Roy McIlroy about this a couple months ago at the Players Championship, where we hear, you know, improve the product, engage the fans, what does that actually mean? He said the example of Formula One. You and I don't believe, have ever been to a Formula One race, but it is a 3 or 4 day event, big money, there's parties, there are things going on the periphery more than just the race and the competition. That is what I believe the PGA Tour wants to do moving forward, and that is what I think LIV Adelaide, at least, has tapped into. Yes, you have the 54 hole golf tournament, but you also have concerts each night. You have other stuff for fans to do. And I think you see a massive turnout, 95,000 fans, I believe, was the number that LIV Golf cited. Again, I don't think that's necessarily translating to the TV product, but it's clear that this is the best event that LIV has to offer and something they're going to continue to try to tap into.
Yeah, and it was last year too. If you go back, yep. I think it was by far the most successful event in you and I both have been to Australia, and it is a golf-starved nation. And if you can bring them stars, if you can bring them quality golf, even if it's 54 holes, even if it's a team event, like they don't have a hard time wrapping their mind around this and getting behind the event. By all accounts, I was told Singapore and Hong Kong were the same thing. When I've talked to people and players who are at those live events, I think it just, if you go to the right market, that is, and I hate to give credence to Greg here, but to his point that if you're willing to wrap your mind around the idea that this is golf, just a little bit different, then yeah, I think you can turn that into something special. And the Formula One model is probably the perfect model for, if not the PGA Tour, certainly SSG, because that is by far the path forward. If you want to turn PGA Tour Enterprises, the for-profit arm of the tour now, into something that's profitable, that's the easiest pathway forward. And you do that in conjunction with LIV Golf. I will say there's already tour events that do this. I mean, Scottsdale being the primary example now, but if you look at other events, the American Express has a concert pretty much every night, starting on Monday night all the way through.
Championship does it. I'm saying it's going to look more, I think, a lot more like Phoenix than it will the Zurich Classic. And again, we keep going to the Zurich Classic and why it was a little bit dead on site. You have Jazz Fest going on at the exact same time. You have a Pelicans playoff game on Saturday afternoon that clearly drew some of the interest there. But I think as an example, it's going to look more like Phoenix than it is going to be Zurich.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, as someone who's I got married in New Orleans, my wife's family's from there. I've spent a good amount of time there. I think if you did it differently there, like if you move that somewhere into the city park, for example, which is, you know, a cab ride from the French Quarter, you turned it into a party, you made it part of Jazz Fest, even. Like there's so many different things you could do at that time of year in New Orleans to turn this into an event, and they just haven't done it. I mean, I don't know if it's because TPC Louisiana is a tour property and they just need to stay there just for monetary reasons. That seems like a silly reason when you could turn it into something really special.
A couple things here to also dive in on LIV Adelaide. I've been saying for a long time in this podcast that I do believe, especially now that LIV has abandoned its pursuit of official world golf ranking points, that they should just completely lean into the team element. And I think that's what was on display over the past couple of days in Australia. I think for the first time, the team competition really overshadowed the individual element. That's not a knock on Brendan Steele, who is a fine player. We both like him personally, getting the $4 million first place prize, the first time he's won a tournament, I believe, since 2017. But you had a first-time team playoff, and it certainly helped to have the hometown team doing battle. But having two players on the Australian team go up against two players on the South African team head-to-head with all that was at stake, I think monetarily, sense of pride, in sort of capturing the imagination of the fans. To me, that felt like a moment for LIV Golf and something that they should get into further. The complication, of course, with that, Rex, is that if you do go strictly into the team format and get away from the individual component, how are the 10 to 12, I think, major worthy players who compete on LIV Golf, how would they respond to less focus on stroke play and more on the team element? They're basically using these golf tournaments to gear up for the major championships, and having more match play, having more team focused competition would only detract from that. You already have John Rahm calling for LIV to move from 54 holes of stroke play to 72 holes of stroke play. I think that's where LIV needs to go, but I don't think its marquee players will sign up for a tour or a circuit that is leaning more in the other direction.
Yeah, you've made this argument before, and I think they're moving in the other direction. I mean, to your point, even Greg talked about, yes, they're open to the idea of playing 72 holes, in which to me is that's sort of just background noise to, okay, that we would be willing to maybe add more individual stroke play to this, lean into the individual side more so than the team side. I get your point. Like, as soon as they lost the battle for world ranking points, it sounds like a good pivot just to lean into the team aspect of it is. I don't know if you get the players to buy off. I don't think you can get the fans, at least in the United States, where it's, they still have the vast majority of their events, to lean into it. It's just not been a popular proposition up until now. And for whatever reason, it works in Adelaide, it works in Asia, it's worked in other places. It just hasn't paid off here in the United States. So I'm not quite sure if you double down, if you decided, okay, we're only going to do team aspects of it. I mean, that to me sounds like you're just being bullheaded at that point.
I think it's also worth pointing out that the LIV Adelaide, at least at this point, is still the outlier. Whether you look at Hong Kong, whether you look at London, whether you look at the tournaments in Saudi Arabia, like they're still getting terrible interest on site from the fan turnout perspective, and they're still losing money. You know, LIV Adelaide still got considerable help from the South Australian government, but with TV production costs, without having any sort of lucrative TV deal, and any other costs associated with putting on a tournament of this magnitude, there's no way that LIV is still covering the $25 million purses that they're offering. And so they're still going to need help from that standpoint. It just seems like having the team format going head-to-head, I think if they want this to grow, if they really want the franchise model to hit among fans, leaning into team play and match play is the way to go. Speaking of this, Rex, and finally, before we do get out of here, because I know it's a little bit awkward in the Delta Sky Lounge at this point. Hello, ma'am. The DP World Tour CEO, the new DP World Tour CEO, Guy Kinnings, said that European players who left for LIV Golf, wink, wink, John Rahm and Terrell Hatton, can still qualify for the 2025 Ryder Cup. He did not say that this is a loophole. He said this is actually not new news, but it is something that he is now bringing attention to, as in those players would be able to play the 2025 Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black if they play enough events to qualify for tour membership before being selected. In other words, this means that those players have a pathway to compete at Bethpage, but it just requires some more work and effort in addition to paying a fine, which if you're making $300+ million, as is the case, John Rahm paying a fine of $1 million or $2 million is probably not going to be that big of a deal. This seems like a pretty good compromise and a pretty good path forward for the European Ryder Cup team in particular.
I actually got a text message from one of our producers up in Connecticut asking about the story. It was on golfdigest.com. It was by our buddy John Huggins. And he said, is this newsworthy? Should he put it in the show that night? And I said, no, this has always been the case. This has always been the rules. If you go back, I mean, just go back just a few weeks, there were LIV players playing in the Porsche Open in Germany. Like, they still can maintain their membership as long as you pointed out, they pay the fines. And it's a lot of money for the fines. I talked to one player on LIV, and it was well into the eight figures. He's not paying that. LIV Golf is paying that. That's sort of the unwritten code here. So it's not like they're having to sign these checks. And they only have to play four events outside of the majors to maintain, that's if they get in the majors, to maintain that membership. So why wouldn't you, if you're John Rahm or you're Terrell Hatton or any of the Europeans who are sort of wringing their hands that you can't be part of the Ryder Cup anymore? No, you still can. And that this hasn't been changed. This isn't new. I actually wrote in my column on Friday that if the PGA Tour is really struggling with how they're going to make this work with LIV Golf, if they come to some sort of agreement with PIF, and we all know that one of the big hangups is going to be how those players who join LIV are either welcome back or not welcome back into the current ecosystem. If you're trying to find some sort of paradigm of hope, if you need a pathway, the European Tour has created it. I mean, this is the easiest pathway to do it, that just lay down fines, lay down suspensions, make some sort of mandatory, okay, if you want to be a tour member again, this is the number of events. It can't be 15. That's not realistic. But like, if you can come up with a realistic way to do it, and the European Tour has. So I think as much as the PGA Tour is struggling with the concept right now, they have created something that the tour should probably study carefully, because there are LIV players who continue to maintain their membership on the European Tour. And make no mistake about it, the European Tour, it's a funding source for them at this point. They're getting a great amount of money for this.
Now, folks like John Rahm, Terrell Hatton, AJ Mironk have all maintained their European Tour membership. What about the European legends last summer, who were basically strong-armed into forfeiting their European Tour membership or forfeiting their European Tour membership? I'm thinking of Sergio Garcia, Lee Westwood, Ian Poulter, Henrik Stenson. Those players gave up their European Tour membership because they basically threw up their hands and said, there's no use. The suspensions, the fines are outrageous. How are those players now feeling when the DP World Tour CEO, Guy Kinnings, is saying, oh, no, this isn't new news. You didn't have to do that.
It's not. So I would turn it back on you. Why did you use the word strong arming? Because this has been their regulation since the very beginning of this. Even when they went through the I think it was called the sports resolution. I mean, the court of resolution, when Ian Poulter and some of the other European players tried to challenge the European Tour's regs. This has always been the case. I think it's why the court ruled in the European Tour's favor, because
how come they all resigned en masse?
Well, probably the fines would be prohibitive if they were paying them. Again, my understanding is they're not paying them anyway. This is coming from LIBGOLF/ the public investment fund. So the only reason not to do it is just to prove a point that if you're Sergio Garcia, for example, and your feelings are probably a little bit hurt because this didn't play out the way you wanted to, then fine, I'm just going to take my ball and I'm going to go home. That's what this feels like to me.
How about Guy Kinnings as well, saying that representatives from the DP World Tour, the PGA Tour, and the Saudi Public Investment Fund have not yet met together when we are nearly 11 months since the announcement of the framework agreement. Did that catch you by surprise? What's your read on that?
No. Again, just like I wasn't surprised when we learned that the player directors on the policy board hadn't met with anybody from the Public Investment Fund, including Yasir Al-Rumayyan, the governor. I don't know. I don't like. Yeah, killed that one. I don't know why they would have. Again, I'm not trying to be disrespectful.
That's 11 months! 11 months!
I mean, it seems to me there's a lot that needs to be done before you bring the player directors in. It seems to me there's a lot that needs to be done before you bring in Guy Kinnings in the European Tour, because this is going to be a deal, essentially. And again, this probably isn't going to make my friends in Europe very happy, but this is going to be a deal, essentially, between the PIF and the PGA Tour. And then whatever becomes of the DP World Tour, that's part of the process. But this is Jay Monahan. This is Yasir Al-Rumayyan. This is those two negotiating this deal.
It's just amazing that there have not even been conversations with those folks in the same room, 11 months removed from the framework agreement. It certainly seems like the sense of urgency is different among all of those parties.
Which I would say that this is the motivation. And Rory touched on this last week when he was asked the idea of why you'd want to go back on the board. And it's because things have been moving so slowly, he feels like he could be sort of that spark that moves him in the right direction. I'm not quite sure if he will be, because I think you still have the conflicts on the board that clearly exist right now. You still have people on one side of the board who want to go in one direction, people on the other side of the board who want to go in a vastly different direction. So I'm not quite sure how Rory bridges that gap.
I also love to tie this all together that we were asked last week on Golf Today by our friend Eamon Lynch whether Roy McIlroy, assuming he does get voted back onto the board, whether that could help or hinder his performance. Well, the week that it becomes known that Roy McIlroy is potentially going back to the board to replace Webb Simpson, he wins the golf tournament with his friend Shane Lowry. As we mentioned, you are in the Delta Sky Lounge. Where are you headed? What are you doing?
Heading to Dallas for the Nelson this week. I'm the Golf Central reporter on property, and you're heading up to Connecticut. Is that right?
This is what I am. I leave in about a half hour's time to get to Stamford, Connecticut, doing the show Tuesday and Wednesday alongside Damon Hack. Very much looking forward to that. Jordan Spieth seems like, Rex, the lone headliner in this AT&T Byron Nelson Field. Jordan Spieth probably wouldn't even be playing this tournament if he was not sponsored by A, AT&T, or B, living in Dallas. What are you actually looking forward to covering this week?
It's these events in between. And I was talking with a producer last night about this, that I don't think that we've done a very good job of sort of telling the stories of players trying to play their way into the signature events. And since we're getting towards the end of the signature events, I want to try to look at these players from the Aon list, the 2 Aon lists, the 5 and the 10 lists, and trying to point out how important it is, specifically this time of year, because we're kind of at that. I know we've only played one major out of four, but I feel like we're at that tipping point in the year where you're going to have to slide on. I thought it was funny yesterday, Rory and Shane talking about one of their motivations for trying to win yesterday was to improve their FedEx Cup status, which is shocking to me. But
and only get 400 points for a win.
Well, Rory, I think they were both outside the top 50, which is sort of the magical number. So I see where they're coming from when you have an issue like that. You have JT. I just looked at the world ranking again this morning. He slipped to 28th in the world ranking again, which means that he's probably going to need some sort of exemption to get into the final signature events. You're going to end up with top players at the end of this season. Like, if that churn rate remains the same, you're going to end up with top players who don't stay in that magical category.
Yes, big week for Rory McIlroy. Not just did he earn a massive hangover from his win and his night in New Orleans chugging Michelob Ultras, but he also now, if the season ended right now, yes, Rory McIlroy would indeed be eligible for the Tour Championship. Very big news. You can catch Rex all week from Dallas, reporting, as he mentioned, on Golf Central. You can catch me on Golf Today on Tuesday, Wednesday. Rex and I will be back for a preview edition of an Elson and anything else that happens in the intervening 48 to 54 hours on another edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab that will drop on Wednesday afternoon. In the meantime, you guys know the drill, nbcsports.com/golf for all the latest news and notes in the world of golf. Thanks as always for listening. Thanks for the support. Have a great start to your work week.